he shouted. We were standing on the terrace in front of the weighing room before the first race, and heads were turning our way. "Billy, for goodness sake, calm down," I said quietly but determinedly. It didn't work. "What the hell are you doing here anyway?" he shouted back. "You should be at your desk getting my bloody cash together!" More heads turned. So much for Patrick's instruction to keep things discreet. "Billy, I'm only trying to help." "I don't need your fucking help!" He curled his lip and spat out the words, spraying me with fine drops of spittle. The racing journalists were moving ever closer. I dropped my voice, leaned forward and spoke directly into his ear. "Now listen to me, you little creep. You clearly need someone's help, and I'm on your side." I paused. "Call me when you've calmed down. The money will be in your bank by Friday." "I told you I need $100,000 by tonight!" he was shouting and almost crying. "I need my money today!" We were now the centre of attention for half the Cheltenham crowd. "Sorry," I said quietly, trying to maintain some level of dignity. "That's impossible. It will be there by Friday, maybe by Thursday, if you're very lucky."
"Thursday will be too late!" he screamed at me. "I'll be fucking dead by Thursday!"
There was no point in us standing there arguing with all the racing world listening to every word, so I simply walked away, ever conscious of the hacks gathering around us like vultures, their pencils now scribbling ferociously in their notebooks. At least there was no sign of Martin Gifford, the five-star gossip. But he'd no doubt know every detail by the end of the day.
"Why are you trying to murder me?" Billy shouted after me at full volume.
I ignored him and continued over towards the relative privacy of the pre-parade ring, where I called the office to check how the liquidation of Billy's assets was progressing. Mrs. McDowd answered. Patrick and Gregory didn't like automated telephone answering and faceless voicemail. "Our clients need to know they're dealing with real people," they said. Hence we employed Mrs. McDowd and Mrs. Johnson to answer the telephones. "What on earth did you say to that policeman?" I asked her. "He's been uncommonly nice to me."
"I told him you were having an ingrown toenail removed."
"Why?"
"Because he was bloody rude to me," she said with indignation. "Spoke to me as if I was the office cleaner, so I told him you couldn't be reached. The trouble was he wanted to know why you couldn't be reached, so I told him you were unconscious, having an operation. What seemed like a good idea at the time. But the damn man was persistent, I'll give him that. Demanded to know what you were having done, so I told him it was an ingrowing toenail. I could hardly make it something more serious now, could I? Not with you up and about, Ike."
"Mrs. McDowd, if I ever need someone to make up an alibi, I promise I'll call you," I said, never thinking for a second that I would need an alibi much sooner than I realized. "Can I speak to Miss Diana, please?" She put me through. The sale of Billy Sells' assets was progressing smoothly, albeit with a sizable loss on some of my recent bond purchases, but did I care? No, probably not. Billy deserved it. I chided myself a little for such non-IFA thoughts, but I was only human. I thanked Diana and disconnected. "Hello, lover boy," said a voice close behind me. "On the phone to my competition."
"Please stop," I said with mock indignation. "People will talk."
Jan Setter cuddled herself up to my back.
"Let them talk," she said, while giving me a tight hug, pressing her whole body against mine. "I want you," she said it into my ear with passion.
This was the second time in 2 days she had made a pass at me in public, and there was nothing casual and light-hearted about this one. Perhaps she really was serious, and that could be a problem. I had always rather enjoyed my flirtatious friendship with Jan, but that was because I had believed we were both just having a bit of verbal fun with no prospect of any actual physical contact. Now, it seemed, the stakes had been raised quite a few notches. I pulled her arms away from my waist and turned round. "Jan," I said firmly, "behave yourself."
"Why should I?" she asked.
"Because you must." She turned down the corners of her mouth like a scolded child. "For a start," I said, "I'm too young for you."
"Oh, thanks a lot," she said crossly, stepping back. "You really do know how to make a woman feel wanted."
There was no mock indignation here. She was angry and hurt.
"Look," I said, "I'm sorry, but I never intended this to get out of hand."
"Nothing has got out of hand," she said. "Things are just as they have been before. Nothing has changed." But we both knew it had, and there would be no going back to as we had been before.
"Great," I said.
She smiled at me ruefully.
But you will let me know if you change your mind. Okay, I smiled back at her. What do you have running?
Nothing, she said. Most of mine are finished now for the summer. She paused.
I only came today because I hoped you would be here.
I stood silently for a moment and looked at her.
I'm sorry, I said.
Yeah, she replied with a sigh. So am I.
Colonel the Honourable Jolyon Westrop Roberts, MCOBE, younger son of the Earl of Balscott, was waiting for me in the same place on the grandstand where I'd met him the previous day.
Ah, oh, Nicholas, he said as I made way up to watch the first race. I was hoping you might be here again today.
Hello, sir, I said. In spite of calling himself plain Mr. Roberts, I knew he liked his formality. How can I help?
Well, he said with a slight laugh, I hope you can help. But there may be nothing to help about, if you know what I mean.
No, sir, I said, I don't know what you mean. You haven't told me anything.
He laughed again nervously.
As I explained to you yesterday, he said, there may be nothing to worry about. In fact, I expect there isn't. I'm probably only wasting your time, and I wouldn't want anyone to get into trouble now, would I?
Sir, I said with some determination, how would I know if you won't tell me? What is it exactly that is worrying you? He stood for a few seconds in silence, looking out over my head towards the racecourse as if deciding whether he should go on.
Gregory, he said finally. I'm worried about Gregory.
What about Gregory? I asked. At times we had all been worried about Gregory. He ate far too much and didn't do any exercise that we were aware of, other than to walk to the end of Lombard Street for a substantial lunch 5 days a week.
It's probably nothing, Jolyon Roberts said again. He stamped his feet and looked uncomfortable. Best forget I ever said anything.
Are you worried about Gregory's health? I asked.
His health? Mr. Roberts repeated with surprise. Why would I worry about Gregory's health?
Then what is it about Gregory that you are worried about?
Jolyon Roberts drew himself up to his full 6'3", the ex-guards colonel who had won a military cross for gallantry as a young subaltern in the Falklands War.
I'm worried about his judgment.
My planned early departure from Cheltenham was put on hold as I steered Mr. Roberts into a quiet corner of the seafood bar for a discussion away from the ears of others. When a client, especially one with such a large investment portfolio as the younger son of the Earl of Balscott, questions the judgment of one of the senior partners, it is no time to hurry away home.
Now, sir, I said, when we were each settled with a plate of prawns and Murray Rose sauce with smoked salmon, in what way do you question Gregory Black's judgment, and why are you telling me?
It's probably nothing, he said again. He has been so good to me over the years, very good. In fact, I'm sure it's nothing.
Why don't you let me be the judge of that?
Yes, he said slowly. I think you might be a good judge. You always were on a horse. It was me who recommended you to Lyle & Black in the first place, don't you know?
No, I didn't know, and I was flattered. No wonder there had been such a welcoming open door when I'd applied for a job.
Thank you, sir, I said. I didn't know.
Oh, yes, said Mr. Roberts. I've had my eye on you since you were 18 years old and won on my cousin's horse at Chepstow. Remarkable piece of writing. Told my cousin then that you would be champion jockey one day.
Bloody shame you got injured.
Yes, I thought once more. It was a bloody shame. But tell me about Gregory Black, I said, trying to get back to the matter in hand.
It's probably nothing, he said once more.
Sir, I said, Colonel Roberts, you must see that you have to tell me now that you have questioned his judgment. I promise you that I will treat what you say in the strictest confidence. At least I hoped I could treat what he told me with confidence. Independent financial advisers were governed by the financial regulator. We were expected to act in a manner that always reflected the highest principles of behaviour. I would not be able to suppress information of wrongdoing solely because it would embarrass another IFA, even if he were my boss. He was still reluctant to start.
Is it about one of your investments? I asked.
Still nothing.
Do you disapprove of something Gregory has asked you to do?
He absent-mindedly ate some of his prawns, the cogs in his mind turning over slowly.
He may be mistaken, he said finally.
Who might be mistaken? Gregory Black? Mr. Roberts looked up at me.
No, he said. My nephew Benjamin.
I was becoming more confused. How might your nephew be mistaken? I asked. He visited the site, and he tells me there are no houses, no factory, and no building work being done on it. In fact, he said it was just waste ground with a large amount of heavy metal pollutants sitting there in stagnant pools. A local government official apparently told him that the cost of removal of the toxic waste would be far greater than the actual value of the land.
I'm sorry, I said, but what has this to do with Gregory Black?
Well, he advised me to invest in the project.
What project? I asked.
A Bulgarian property development project, he said. Houses, shops, and a new factory making low-energy light bulbs.
I vaguely remembered the project being discussed several years ago at one of Patrick's weekly meetings, but as far as I could recall, it had been rejected as too risky an investment for us to recommend to our clients. But that didn't mean that Gregory hadn't thought it a sound investment. Patrick and Gregory may have had both their names on the company notepaper, but they valued their independence even from each other.
Are you sure it's on the same site that your nephew visited? He says so. He says there's no mistake. The site where there should be a factory and hundreds of new homes and shops is nothing but an industrial wasteland. There is even talk of it having been used as a dump for nuclear waste during the Soviet era.
How much have you invested in the scheme? I asked him.
Not that much, he said. The family trust has invested about $5 million into the project as a whole. The factory is named the Balscott Lighting Factory after my father. I've seen pictures of the development. The project is designed to be a great social experiment for one of the most deprived areas of the European Union. A lot of EU money has gone into it.
$5 million may not be that much to Jolyon Roberts and his family trust, but it was a fortune to most people. Do these pictures show a factory and new homes?
Yes, they do. And they show more houses under construction, he said. Gregory Black showed them to me.
But what am I to believe? The photos or my nephew? There must be a simple explanation, I said. Why don't you go and ask Gregory about it? I'm sure he will have invested your money wisely.
I've already approached him, and he just told me not to be so silly. Of course the factory has been built.
But Benjamin is adamant. He says that no Balscott lighting factory exists anywhere in Bulgaria.
So what do you want me to do? I asked him.
Find out the truth.
But why me? I asked. If you think there is a fraud being perpetrated, then you should go to the police or to the financial services regulator.
He sat and looked at me for a moment.
Because I trust you, he said.
But you hardly know me.
I know you much better than you might realize, he smiled. I've been watching your career every step of the way since you first wrote that winner for my cousin, and I normally pride myself on being able to spot the good'uns from the bad'uns. That is why I'm so concerned about this project. After all, it was me who persuaded my brother, Viscount Shennington, that the family trust should invest in something that appeared so worthwhile. I just need to know what is going on.
Sir, I said, I am under an obligation to report it if I find that there is a fraud, or even if there is misrepresentation in advertising and investment.
I see, he said, stroking his chin. My brother and I are most concerned that the good name of the Roberts family should not be dragged through the courts. He is in favour of simply writing off the investment and saying nothing. However, he stopped.
You feel responsible? I asked.
Exactly, he said. But I would prefer it if you could be very discreet. If this is a scam, well, to be honest, I would rather not have everybody know that I've been a fool.
Especially your brother. He looked me in the eye and smiled.
Trustworthy and wise.
But I will have to talk to Gregory about it, I said.
Can you not have a little look at things first without telling anybody? I'm sure that someone with your keen nose for a good investment will be able to spot a rotten egg pretty quickly if there's one to find.
I laughed. I think you have the wrong person. My nose isn't that keen.
Oh, I think it is, Jolyon Roberts replied. I have a friend who's forever telling me about all the money you've made for her in films and theatre.
I've just been lucky, I said.
Yes, he said, smiling. You and Arnold Palmer?
I looked at him quizzically.
You're too young, he said, laughing. Arnold Palmer the golfer.
What about him? I asked.
When a reporter once asked him why he was so lucky in golf, he famously replied, "It's a funny thing. The harder I practice, the luckier I get."
But my luck was about to run out. Chapter 5. True to his word, Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson sent a car to collect me from home on Thursday morning,
and he was waiting at Herb Kovacs' flat when I arrived at 8 a.m. sharp.
"Ah, good morning, Mr. Foxton," he said, opening the front door and offering his hand. "And how is your toe today?"
"It's fine," I said, honestly. "It doesn't hurt at all." And I'd forgotten to limp.
"Nasty things in growing toenails," he said. "Had one myself years ago. Hurt like hell."
"Luckily I'm a quick healer," I said. "Now, how can I help?" He stepped to the side and I walked past him and into the hallway of Herb's flat. I still thought of it as Herb's flat, although I supposed it was now technically mine, or would be in due course.
"Are you certain Mr. Kovac was not in personal financial difficulties?" the chief inspector asked while closing the front door.
"No, I'm not certain, but I have no reason to think he was. Why do you ask?" He waved a stack of papers towards me.
"What are they?" I asked.
"Credit card statements," said the chief inspector.
"So?" "Mr. Kovac appears to have had more than 20 credit cards, and according to these statements, at his death, he owed nearly £100,000 on these cards alone."
I could hardly believe it. Not only because Herb was in so much debt, but also because his debt was on credit cards. If anyone knew how expensive it was to borrow on plastic, then a financial advisor would. Even with interest rates historically low, the annual percentage rate on credit cards was typically between 16% and 20%, with some even as high as 30%. Borrowing money on credit cards was a mug's game. The interest charges alone on a debt as big as that would be around $1,500 a month. That was about half what Herb was taking home in salary after the usual deductions for tax and national insurance. If Herb had owed nearly $100,000 on credit cards, then his flat must surely be mortgaged to the hilt.
It certainly wouldn't end up being mine. More likely the bank's.
And yet, he'd always had plenty of money in his pocket. He was extravagant even in his spending, always wearing new clothes and dining out as the norm. It didn't make sense.
"Can I have a closer look at those?" I asked the chief inspector, reaching out for the papers.
He handed them over and I skimmed through the first three or four statements.
There was no doubt that the outstanding balance on each was very large and in some cases close to the maximum limit, but that did not show the full picture, not by a long way. I looked through the rest. They were all the same.
"Didn't you notice something unusual about these?" I asked.
"Notice what?" said the chief inspector.
"There are no interest payments from previous months. All these charges, on all of these statements, they're all new." I turned a statement over to look at the detailed breakdown and to see what Herb had spent £100,000 on in a month, and was shocked again. There were no purchases as such, just payments to and from a plethora of internet gambling and online casino sites. Masses of them. I looked through all the statements, and they were the same. Many of the payments were quite modest, but one or two ran into the thousands. Quite a few of the betting sites had actually paid money back to the accounts, but most showed a deficit. Overall, Herb had been a loser, not a winner, nearly £100,000 a month loser. All the statements showed clearly that the previous month's balances had been settled in full by the due date. I mentally added them up. As well as still owing almost £100,000, Herb had paid nearly the same amount in gambling debts to the cards during March alone. Where had he obtained that sort of money? And how on earth had he had the time to gamble on so many different sites with so many different credit cards while working full-time at Lyle and Black? It sure as hell didn't make any sense. As Claudia had said, you never really knew what even your closest friends were up to. Could this compulsive online gambling somehow be the reason that Herb was killed? The totals may have been large, but the individual entries on the statements were modest and surely not big enough to initiate murder.
"There are some other things I'd like you to have a look at," said the chief inspector. "You may be able to help me understand them."
He turned and walked down the hallway, turning left through a door. I followed him. Herb's living room was in true bachelor pad fashion, with half of it taken up by a single deep armchair placed in front of a large, wall-mounted flat-screen television. On the far side of the room was a large desk with a laptop computer, a printer, and three piles of papers in metal baskets. It was some of the papers that the chief inspector wanted me to look at.
"We need your permission, as Mr. Kovac's executor, to remove certain items that we believe may help with our inquiries. These, for example. But we would like your opinion on them first.
He handed me two sheets of paper, covered entirely on both sides by handwritten lists with columns of what appeared to be dates, with amounts of money alongside, together with a further column of capital letters.
Could they have something to do with Mr. Kovac's work?
I studied the lists briefly.
I doubt it, I said.
They're handwritten and we do everything on computer. I think these could be amounts of money. I pointed at the center two columns. And these look like dates.
Yes, he said, I worked that much out, but do you know what they are?
Do they correspond to the amounts on the credit card statements, I asked.
No, I looked at that. None of the figures are the same.
How about last month's statements, I said. Most of these dates are last month.
We've been unable to locate any statements other than those you have seen. But some of the dates on this list would have been for the statements we have, and none of the amounts match.
Then I'm afraid I can't help you, I said. I don't recognise any of the amounts, and individually, most are far too small to be anything to do with Mr. Kovac's work. We always work in thousands, if not tens of thousands. Most of these are hundreds. I looked once more at the lists. Could that third column be people's initials? The chief inspector looked.
It might be.
Do you recognise any of them? For example, do they match any of your work colleagues? I scanned through the list. Not that I can see.
Right, he said suddenly, as if making a decision. With your permission, we will take these papers away together with the credit card statements, Mr. Kovac's laptop computer, and these other things.
The chief inspector waved a hand towards a box on a side table near the door. I went over and looked in. The box contained various bits and pieces, including Herb's American passport, an address book, a desk diary, and a folder full of bank statements. It was all rather sad.
It's fine by me, I said.
But you do know that his computer won't give you access to Mr. Kovac's work files.
So I believe.
He would have been able to access the office files and emails through his laptop, but no records of them would have been stored on it. The laptop would have merely been acting as a keyboard and a screen for the firm's mainframe computer in Lombard Street.
Nevertheless, said the chief inspector, it is our policy to search through such a device for any correspondence that might have a bearing on his death. I trust you are happy with that.
Absolutely, I agreed.
Good, he said, folding the computer flat and placing it in the box with the other things. But can I make copies of that credit card stuff before you take it away? I do know that one of the first tasks for executors is to close the bank accounts and pay the debts of the deceased. But goodness knows where I'll get 100,000 to do that. How much did he have in the bank?
Not that much, said the chief inspector.
Do you mind if I look? I asked.
Not at all, he said. I understand from Mr. Kovac's lawyer that it will be yours anyway.
I pulled the folder of bank statements out of the box and looked at the most recent ones. The balance was quite healthy, but as DCI Tomlinson had said, it didn't run to anything like 100,000. More like a tenth of that. I unclipped the last statement from the folder and made a photocopy using the printer copier on the desk. I then photocopied all the credit card statements and both sides of the two sheets of handwritten figures before handing them all back to the policeman.
Thank you, he said. I just need your signature on this form to give us permission to remove these items, and I have a receipt for them to give you.
He handed me the form, which I signed, and the receipt, which I put in my pocket.
Bloody paperwork, he said, taking back the form. These days, we have to be so damn careful to do everything exactly according to the book, or some clever dick defence lawyer will claim that any evidence we find is not admissible in court. I can tell you, it's a bloody nightmare.
Although better on the whole, I thought, than the police marching in anywhere they liked in their size 12 boots, taking away any stuff they wanted without permission, and for no good reason. He packed his paperwork into the box along with the other things.
Now, Mr. Foxton, he said, could you just wander round the flat to satisfy yourself that we'd left the place in reasonable order, and also to check that nothing appears out of place or is missing?
I'm happy to have a look, I said, but I've never been in here before, so I don't know what it looked like before you arrived.
Please, anyway, he said, putting his hand out towards the door.
He followed me as I went round the flat, looking briefly in each of the two bedrooms, the bathroom, and the well-fitted kitchen. Nothing to my eye appeared out of place, but of course it wouldn't.
Have you searched everywhere? I asked. Not a proper forensic search, he said. We haven't taken the floorboards up or knocked holes in the walls, that sort of thing. but we had a reasonable look around to see if there was anything that could assist us in determining why he was killed. Mr. Kovac was the victim of the crime, not the perpetrator.
How did you get in? I asked as we went back along the hallway. The front door doesn't seem to have been forced.
The key was in Mr. Kovac's trouser pocket.
I thought again about Herb lying silent and cold in some morgue refrigerator.
How about his funeral? I asked.
What about it?
He said. I suppose it's my job to organize it.
Not before the coroner has released the body, he said.
And when will that be? I asked.
Not just yet, he replied.
He hasn't been formally identified, but I told you who he was.
Yes, sir, he said with irony. I know that, and we are pretty certain we know who he is because you told us. But you are not his next of kin, and to be fair, you have only known him for 5 years. He could have told you he was Herbert Kovac while not actually being so.
You're showing that suspicious mind of yours again, Chief Inspector, he smiled.
We are still trying to trace his next of kin, but so far without success. I know he lived in New York just before he came to England, I said, but he was brought up in Kentucky, in Louisville. At least, that is what he said.
Did I now doubt it?
Yes, said the Chief Inspector. We have been in touch with our counterparts in New York and Louisville, but so far they have been unable to contact any members of his family. It would appear that his parents are deceased.
Can you give me any idea of when a funeral can be held?
Not at present, he said. I imagine it won't be for a few weeks at least. Maybe his remains will need to be sent back to the United States.
Don't I decide that, as the executor of his will? I asked.
Maybe, he said. Depends on the formal identification. But I'll leave that up to the coroner. In the meantime, if you think of anything else that might help us with our inquiries, please call me.
He dug in his inside pocket for a card.
Use the mobile number. It's usually on all the time, and you can leave a message if it's not.
I put the card in my wallet, and Chief Inspector Tomlinson collected the box of possible evidence.
Can I offer you a lift home? He asked.
No, thank you. I think I'll have a look around here first. I can catch the bus.
Don't overdo it with that toe, he said. That's what I did with mine, and it took weeks to get right.
I'll be careful, I said with an inward smile. I would, in fact, be going into the office and not home when I left here. Now, how do I lock up?
Ah, yes, he replied, digging into his coat pocket. I had another key cut. We would like to hang on to one for the time being, just in case we need to pop back to look through his things further.
Right, I said, taking the offered key. Are you based down here, then? I thought you were Merseyside police.
I am, he replied, but I'm working on this case out of Paddington Green all this week. I will be going home on Friday.
And you'll let me know when I can start making funeral arrangements.
The Liverpool coroner will be in contact with you in due course, he said rather unhelpfully. And then he departed, carrying his box of potential treasures under his arm.
I sat for a while at Herb's desk, looking again at the credit card statements. There were between 20 and 30 internet gambling or online casino websites on each statement. Half of them I didn't recognize, but their names showed what they were. One was called www.oddsandevens.net, and another www.pokermillions.co.eg. It didn't take a genius to work it out. Not every statement had all the same sites, but some were on all of them, and all appeared at least half a dozen times. I started adding up. In total, there were 22 different credit cards and 512 different entries on the statements. The total owed was £94,626.52. Some of the entries on all of the statements were credits, but overall, the average loss per entry was a fraction under £185. I checked the actual amounts against those on the handwritten lists, but as the Chief Inspector had said, not one of them matched. It wasn't so much the amount of money that amazed me, even though it did. It was the number of different entries. Again, I wondered how Herb had had the time to play or gamble online with 512 different logins. I did some more mental arithmetic. Without work, eating or sleeping, spending every moment of the day for a whole month at the computer would have given him just an hour and a half on each account. It was impossible. I stood up and went into the kitchen.
My mother always maintained that one could learn most about a person by looking in their fridge. Not with Herb. His fridge was starkly empty, with just a plastic carton of skimmed milk and a half-full tub of low-fat spread. His cupboards were almost equally bare, with a couple of boxes of breakfast cereal and half a loaf of bread gone stale. On the worktop were a jar of instant coffee and two round tins with tea and sugar printed on their outsides, and with some tea bags and granulated sugar on their insides. I filled the electric kettle and made myself a cup of coffee. I took it back to the desk in the living room and went on studying the credit card statements. I spotted that there was something else slightly odd about them. They didn't all have the same name or the same address at the top. Some of them had this flat's address, and others the Lyle and Black office's address in Lombard Street. Nothing too unusual about that, but the names on them also varied. Not very much, but enough for me to notice. I looked through them again, carefully making two piles on the desk, one for each address. There were 11 statements in each pile, and 11 slight variations in Herb's name, Herb Kovac, Mr. Herb E. Kovac, Herbert Kovac Esquire, Mr. H. Kovac, Herbert E. Kovac, Mr. H. E. Kovac, H. E. Kovac Jr., H. Edward Kovac, Bert Kovac Jr., Herbert Edward Kovac, and Mr. Bert E. Kovac. No two statements had the same name and address. Now, why did I think that was suspicious? I heard the key turn in the door and thought that DCI Tomlinson must have forgotten something. I was wrong. I went out into the hallway to find an attractive blonde-haired young woman struggling through the front door with an enormous suitcase. She saw me and stopped.
"Who the hell are you?"
she demanded in a Southern American accent. I'd been about to ask her the same thing. "Nicholas Foxton," I said. "And you?"
"Cherry Kovac," she said. "And where's my damn brother?"
There was no easy way to tell Sherry that her brother was dead. But it was the nature of his death she found most distressing. She sat in the big armchair and wept profusely while I made her a cup of hot, sweet tea. In between bouts of near hysteria, I discovered that she had arrived early that morning on an overnight flight from Chicago. She had been surprised and rather annoyed that Herb had not been at the airport to meet her as he had promised, but she had eventually made her own way to Hendon by train and taxi. "But how did you have a key to get in?" I asked her.
"Herb gave me one when I was here last year."
Herb hadn't mentioned to me last year that his sister was visiting, or even that he had a sister in the first place, but why would he have? We'd been work colleagues rather than close friends. He also hadn't mentioned to me that he was a compulsive online gambler. I wondered if I ought to inform DCI Tomlinson that Herb Kovac's next of kin had turned up. Probably. But then he'd be back round here with a list of awkward questions when it was clear to me that after a night of sitting upright on an aeroplane, what she needed most was a good sleep. I'd call the chief inspector later. I found some fresh bed linen in an airing cupboard and made up the bed in the smaller of the two bedrooms. I then guided the overtired and still crying Miss Kovac from the living room to the bed and made her take off her shoes and lie down. "You sleep for a bit," I said, covering her with a blanket. "I'll still be here when you wake."
"But who are you exactly?"
she asked between sobs. "A friend of your brother's," I said. "We worked together." I decided not to mention to her just yet that her brother had left his entire estate to me and not to her. And I wondered why that was. Sherry Kovac was almost asleep before her head reached the pillow. I left her there and went back to Herb's desk and the credit card statements. It was gone 9 o'clock and I called the office number on my mobile. Mrs. McDowd answered.
"It's the man with the ingrowing toenail calling in sick," I said.
"Shirker,"
she announced with a laugh.
"No, really," I said. "I won't be in the office until later. Please tell Mr. Patrick that I'm sorry, but something has come up."
"Trouble?"
she asked. "No," I said, "no trouble, but something that I need to deal with."
I could almost feel her wanting to ask what it was. Mrs. McDowd liked to know everything about the goings-on of her staff, as she called us. She was always asking after Claudia, and she seemed to know more about my mother than I did.
"Tell me, Mrs. McDowd," I said in a friendly tone, "did you know that Herb Kovac had a sister?"
Yes, of course, she said. Sherry. She lives in Chicago. She and Mr. Herb were twins. She visited him last summer.
Did you proffer this information to the policeman when he interviewed us all on Monday?
No, she said firmly. I did not.
Why not? I asked her.
He didn't ask me.
Mrs. McDowd clearly didn't like the police very much.
Please tell Mr. Patrick that I'll see him later today, I said.
Right, I will, she said. It's a good job you're not here now anyway. Mr. Gregory is angry, fit to burst.
What about? I asked.
You, she said. He's absolutely livid. Claims you've brought the whole firm into disrepute. He wants your head on a stick.
But why? I asked, rather worried. What have I done?
Don't you know?
No, I said.
Read the front page of the Racing Post.
I went along the hall to check on Sherry. Her long blonde hair was obscuring her face, so I waited in the doorway for a few seconds, listening to her breathing. She was sound asleep. Best thing for her, I thought. Sadly, the horrors of real life would still be waiting for her when she woke. As quickly as I could, I slipped out the front door and walked down towards Hendon Central in search of a newsagent. I could see the problem even before I picked up the paper. The inch-high bold headline read, Foxy Foxton and Billy Searle in £100,000 gamble? I bought the paper with shaking hands and stood reading it in the shop. In addition to the headline, there were photographs of Billy and me, mine taken during my racing days wearing racing colours and cap. The article beneath was as damning as the headline. Leading national hunt jockey Billy Searle was observed in a heated argument at Cheltenham Races yesterday with former fellow jockey Nick Foxy Foxton. The topic of their acrimonious exchange? Money. According to the Racing Post correspondent of the course, the amount under discussion was in excess of £100,000, with Searle demanding instant payment of this amount, which he claimed he was owed by Foxton. At one point, Searle was heard to ask why he, Foxton, wanted to murder Searle. Could this all be connected with Foxy's new job at City financial firm Lyle & Black, where he gambles daily with other people's money on the stock markets? Well-known trainer Martin Gifford stated that Foxton had informed him on Tuesday that Herbert Kovac, the man whose murder last Saturday led to the postponement of the Grand National, was Foxton's best friend and a fellow stock market speculator who had also worked for Lyle & Black. Gifford implied that Foxton may have known more about the killing than he was telling. Not surprisingly, people yesterday were asking if Foxton's argument with Searle could have had some sinister connection to the Aintree murder. The rules of racing clearly ban gambling by professional jockeys, but no such restriction applies to former jockeys. The Racing Post will endeavour to keep its readers up to date with this story. The article cleverly didn't actually accuse Billy Searle or me of any wrongdoing. It merely asked leading questions. But there was little doubt that the tone of the piece was designed to imply there was a criminal conspiracy between us, which also had something to do with the death of Herb Kovac. No wonder Gregory Black was steaming round the office fit to burst. I was surprised my phone wasn't ringing off the hook. Bugger, I thought. What should I do now? I called Patrick on his mobile. I didn't fancy using the office number just in case Gregory himself answered, as we all sometimes did if the receptionists were busy on other calls.
Hello, Nicholas, said Patrick. I thought I told you to be discreet. I hear that Gregory's after your blood. I'd keep your head down if I were you.
I will, I said, but it's all a pack of lies.
You know that, and I know that, but unfortunately Joe Bloggs in the street will believe what he reads in the paper.
But they have completely distorted the truth. It's so unfair.
Tell that to the politicians, he laughed. I have already told Gregory not to believe what he reads, but he says quite rightly that you shouldn't have been having a public argument with a client in the first place. He's pretty mad.
It wasn't an argument, I claimed in my defence. Billy Searle just started shouting and swearing at me for no reason.
Don't worry about it, Patrick said. It'll all blow over in a couple of days.
I wish he'd been right. Chapter 6. I walked back to Herb's flat, hardly feeling my feet on the pavement. What a bloody mess. I could imagine that Billy Searle wasn't too happy about it either. I thought the last thing he'd want would be the racing authorities asking him questions about why he needed £100,000 so urgently. I let myself in through Herb's front door and went to check again on Sherry. She hadn't moved and was still sound asleep. I left her alone and went back to the living room, where I sat at Herb's desk wishing I'd brought my laptop with me. It was lying on the kitchen table in Finchley, and I was tempted to go home to fetch it. Instead, I called Claudia.
Hi, it's me, I said when she answered. Hi, you, she replied. Could you bring my computer over to Herb's flat, I said. His sister has turned up and she didn't know he was dead. She's sleeping now, but I don't feel I can leave her for long. I'll stay and work here, but I do need my laptop. I decided against mentioning as yet the unwelcome coverage in the Racing Post. There was a slight pause. Okay, Claudia said in a slightly irritated tone. It's not very far, I said encouragingly. Use the car. You won't need to park or anything. Just drop it off. Okay, she said again, lacking enthusiasm. But I was just going out. Bloody hell, I thought. It wasn't very much to ask. Where are you going? I asked. Oh, nowhere, she said. Just to have coffee with a friend. Who? No one you know, she said evasively. Probably one of her artist friends. I didn't know them and I didn't really want to. Some of them were as weird as her paintings. Please, Claudia, I said firmly. I need it here so I can do my job. And to bring in the money so you can live rent-free, I thought, but didn't say. Okay, she said once more resigned. Where is the flat? I gave her the address and she promised she would bring the computer right over. While I waited, I went through the piles of papers on Herb's desk, those remaining after the chief inspector had taken his box away. There were the usual clutter of utility bills and debit card receipts, interleaved with financial services magazines, insurance documents, and some personal letters. I glanced through them all, but nothing gave any clue to who would want Herb dead, or how he came to gamble away £100,000 a month on the internet. I didn't expect them to. I assumed that the police would have removed anything of interest. Next, I went through the desk drawers. There were three on each side, and the ones on the left contained such exciting items as a stapler with spare staples, various sized brown envelopes, paper and ink cartridges for the printer, a pack of permanent markers in bright colours, a plastic tub of large paper clips, and a calculator. Those on the right were only partially more interesting, with a large pile of paid bills, various income tax papers, a copy of Herd's United States tax return, a rubber band bound stack of received Christmas cards, and a plastic folder containing monthly payslips from Lyle and Black. I was curious to see that Herb had been paid somewhat more than I was, no doubt due to his 3 years prior experience at J.P. Morgan Asset Management in New York, before moving to London. Now that I was Patrick's most senior assistant, I would have to have a discussion with him about a raise. I flicked through the bills, but there was nothing that appeared to shine out like a lighthouse to guide me to his killer, although I did notice that Herb had been what my mother always described as a free-spending spirit. It was a term she used for those she considered to squander their money on lavish, unnecessary purchases instead of prudently saving it for a rainy day, as she had always done. Two separate invoices from a local travel agent showed that Herb's free spending had run to at least two British Airways first-class round-trip tickets across the Atlantic at £8,000 each, one of them dated only the previous month for a planned but not yet taken trip in May. He may have been earning more than me, but there was no way he could have financed those out of his income from Lyle and Black, even without the online gambling debts he had run up on the credit cards. I wondered if he'd inherited a large sum from his dead parents. I thought it unlikely, as he'd always claimed that his father had gambled away most of his family's money, but perhaps Herb had been busy spending and gambling away the rest. But where had he kept it? I looked again at the photocopy I had made of his last bank statement. I had only made it to have a record of Herb's account number and sort code. I would need them when I contacted the bank to inform them of his death. The latest balance was a little under £10,000. But there were no entries on the statements that appeared to be payments for the credit card accounts, and certainly no £8,000 to the travel agent the previous month. Herb had to have had another bank account, but there was no sign of it anywhere in his desk. I looked at my watch. I had called Claudia nearly half an hour ago, and the journey should have taken her only 10 minutes from Litchfield Grove Finchley to Seymour Way, Hendon. I went to the door to see if she was outside somewhere, but there was no sign of her, or the Mercedes. I waited in the doorway for 5 further minutes with slightly increasing irritation. I didn't really want to call her again, but she was beginning to try my patience. Once, I would have been so excited by the prospect of seeing her, I wouldn't have minded if she'd been half a day late arriving. On one occasion, I'd been at Heathrow Airport at least 2 hours before her flight was due to land, just to be sure not to miss her arriving through customs. But now, and not for the first time, I wondered if our relationship had run its course.
She finally arrived some 35 minutes after I had called. She stopped in the middle of the road and put down the passenger window. I leaned through it and picked up my computer from the seat. "Thanks," I said. "See you later." "Okay," she said, and drove off quickly. I stood in the road waving, but even if she could see me, she didn't wave back. There had been a time when we never parted without us waving vigorously until we were completely out of sight of each other. I sighed. I had invested so much of my emotional capital in my relationship with Claudia, and the thought of being single again, having to start out once more, did not fill me with any joy. And I wasn't at all sure I wanted it to end. Claudia still excited me, and the sex was good, albeit somewhat rarer than it once had been. In fact, sex had been non-existent over the last couple of weeks, with Claudia always making some excuse. So what had gone wrong? Why was she suddenly not so loving towards me? I wondered if she was seeing someone else, but who? Surely not one of her artistic layabout friends from her time at our college. The thought of her being intimate with one of them was enough to make me feel ill, and not a little bit angry. Miserably, I went back into Herb's flat and sat down again at his desk, but even with my computer I couldn't concentrate on any work, due to thinking about the article in the paper and also about Claudia. After about half an hour, I called her mobile, but it went straight to voicemail. I didn't leave a message because I didn't know what to say. Instead, I logged onto the internet through Herb's router and checked my office emails, many of which were junk from various finance firms offering rates of return that were well above the norm for the market. Nestled amongst the trash were three work emails from this morning, one from Diana confirming the sales of all Billy Searle's assets and the impending transfer from the firm's client account to his bank, one from Patrick asking me to research a new personal pension plan being offered by one of the leading providers in the light of the new pension legislation, and the third from Jessica Winter advising me to wear a bulletproof vest if I was planning on coming into the office. I thought it a particularly insensitive comment, considering what had happened to Herb only 5 days previously. I looked again at all the junk mail. If a promised return appeared to be too good to be true, then it invariably was just that, too good to be true. I thought back to my conversation with Jolyon Roberts at Cheltenham the previous day. Had the promised return on the Bulgarian property development project been too good to be true? Not as far as I could remember. It had not been the level of return that had been the concern, rather the distance away and the potential difficulty in acquiring accurate and up-to-date information on the progress of the project. In fact, just the problem that Mr. Roberts believed to be the issue. I started to type Roberts into the company client index, but thought better of it. The office mainframe computer kept a record of all files accessed, so any of us could see who'd been looking at each file. It wasn't particularly designed to spy on us or to prevent us accessing files. Indeed, it made it easy to keep a record of files visited. I could expect my files to be accessed by Patrick on a fairly random but regular basis, and the company files as a whole were regularly scrutinized by Jessica Winter, our compliance officer. Whenever any of us opened a file, it clearly showed in the top right-hand corner of the computer screen a list of the 5 people in the firm who had accessed the file most recently, together with the date and time of their access. As one of the IFAs, I had authority to look at any of the company files, but I might have had difficulty explaining to Gregory why I had accessed those of one of his clients without his knowledge, especially a client as important as the Roberts Family Trust. And especially now. I told myself that I should go straight to Gregory and Patrick, and probably to Jessica as well, and tell them about my conversation with Jolyon Roberts and get the matter looked at by them. But did I really want to go and accuse Gregory of misleading one of his clients, and on today of all days? Then I would truly need that bulletproof vest. Unlike in the United States, where the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, employs a prescriptive rule-based regime, the United Kingdom authorities had moved to a principles-based regulatory system. The onus was now on me to act in a manner that upheld the highest principles of honesty, openness, and integrity, and to prove it. It was difficult to decide which system was the better. Experience had shown that neither was fraud-proof. Indeed, the SEC had investigated Bernie Madoff several times without unearthing the biggest individual fraud in American history. Talk about the asylum being run by the lunatics. Madoff served three times as chairman of the Nasdaq stock market. And that was many years after he had started his fraud, and even after the first failed SEC investigation into his company's activities. And he just had to be called Madoff, hadn't he? He'd made off with $65 billion. Yes, billion. And all because he'd been able to fraudulently circumvent the fixed US regulatory rules. Whereas in the UK, it was not just the letter of the law I had to follow, but also its spirit. But was I, in fact, following the spirit of principles-based regulation, not to mention immediately to my superiors and to the compliance officer that a client of the firm was questioning the judgment of one of the senior partners? Probably.